Clean contact.
I'd hit it again because that shot was a defining moment. And when a defining moment comes along, you define the moment, or the moment defines you.
Here it comes. Oh my goodness.
Hello and welcome to the Golf Practice Podcast. My name is Andy Hayes, and with me on this Masters week is Peter Donahue. Peter, thanks for joining me today.
Andy, it's nice to see you again, and it's getting exciting, isn't it? Yeah. Leading up to the Masters is always exciting.
I mean, the greatest week of the year. Has this always been one of your favorite tournaments, if not the favorite?
I think so. In my growing up, when I started really following golf back in the early 60s, you know, it was Arnold Palmer and Jack Nicklaus, and there wasn't a lot of events covered, you know, and the Masters was really, we were all coming out of wintertime here in Illinois, as we've all just experienced, and spring, you know, is a very, very optimistic period around here, but the weather isn't always so great. But when you can experience the magnificence of spring in Georgia in April, it's exciting on that level. And then the Masters has always been one of the leaders in television golf broadcasting, and so it's always been a cool television experience.
Great. So the theme of this podcast is what it's like to play Augusta National. You're the only person I've ever met in my life who's played Augusta National. And that's actually all that I know about this story. So I'm really looking forward to hearing what you have to say. Maybe before we get to that, did you first attend Augusta attend the Masters as a spectator before playing it?
Yes, I did. It was many years ago, though. Let me think right now. Certainly about 45 years ago, my father and I went. He had friends who business associates that lived in Augusta, and so we got in that way. And I remember trying to follow Jack Nicklaus in those days, and you just couldn't. I just remember that, you know, we were like 13 rows back, and you could see Jack's blonde head bobbing up and down, but that was about it. So we decided to walk the golf course, and we followed a guy named Bobby Nichols and Hubert Green. And Hubert Green had a really kind of singular, unique swing, and watching these two guys play the golf course, nobody was following them. But I got to see a lot of the golf course then. And then, you know, many years went by, and I was hoping one day I might be able to play there, and pretty much had given up hope.
So let's hear the story. Start with like the invitation or who you knew or what happened.
Yeah, well, I think I'll leave the name of the member out for their protection,
was it Condoleezza Rice?
No, okay. It wasn't Connie.
Okay.
I got a call. I would say 6 years ago. I got a call in early March, and it was the executive assistant for this old classmate of mine, and she said she was very nice, and she said that her boss wanted her to reach out to me to see if I might possibly want to join him at Augusta National in the 3 weeks or whatever that was to play a round of golf and to, you know, spend the night at Augusta. As I said, I'd really given up hope that would ever happen. I was okay with it. You know, I said, well, you know, there's lots of things I won't be able to do in life. It'd be nice to be able to play Augusta, but I'd pretty much put it on the back burner. And so I, you know, of course I jumped at the chance, and I was, I happened to be, at that time I had a student whose parents rented a place down in Florida throughout the winter, and they would fly him down to Florida so that he could play golf outside, and they would fly me down three times during the winter. And so it just so happened that I was in Florida and could just then drive the rental car up to Savannah and then across to Augusta.
Cool.
Yeah, it was really cool. The drive was really cool, you know, driving into Savannah, which is just a gorgeous town with, you know, all the low-hanging trees and the Spanish moss and, you know, the old architecture, and then driving across the state to Augusta and driving through, you know, rural Georgia is an interesting experience. I mean, it's very rural, and I love the drive. And then once I got into Augusta, it was sort of like a spy thing. Because the rule at Augusta is, as a guest, you cannot go on to campus unless your host is on campus.
Wow.
So my friend was getting in, you know, around 5 o'clock. So the instructions I got via the phone through his assistant was, I just had to hang out somewhere in Augusta and wait for the phone call. And so that's what I did. I sat in a shopping center parking lot and read a book and waited for the call. And when the call came in, you know, you head for the gate, and of course, you know, everybody there is the epitome of Southern hospitality. I mean, there's just from the gate guard to you drive down Magnolia.
So, are you looking this up like on a paper map? How do you know where to go?
Well, how did I know where to go? I mean, certainly in those days, your phone could tell you, couldn't it? Isn't that how I must have gotten
you had your
there.
Phone. So you can type, I guess you can, yeah, Augusta, and it just takes you right there.
Takes you right over there. Well, however it was, I found the place. And, of course, Augusta didn't look anything as a town like it looked, you know, 45 years ago when I was there for the first time. But man, driving down Magnolia Lane, I mean, it's everything. You know, there you are. You know, you've seen this thing on television mm-hmm. forever, because, you know, that's
so this, for people who haven't, it's more than just a road. What's Magnolia Lane?
Well, it goes from the front entrance. It's a dead straight road, and it goes right up to the circular drive around the clubhouse. So from the moment you come in the gate, and you're looking at Magnolia Lane, it is literally lined with magnolia trees. I mean, very thick to the road. The first thing, you know, you notice about the road is that there's not a speck of dirt. And everything about the curbs has been perfectly painted and stenciled. And there isn't a blade of grass that's out of place, and you've often heard that. But literally, when I drove my car up and got out around the clubhouse, because they get you assembled there, okay, before they then lead you out to the cabins or the parking lot, you know, where you'll park your car and then stay in there in the cabins. I got out of the car and I was looking down at the sidewalk, and I thought, this thing looks like it had been cut by a barber. I mean, there wasn't even a blade of grass overhanging the concrete. I mean, it didn't look like it had been edged, you know, with some crude edger. Yeah. It looked like literally someone had come out with knee shears. Pads.
Yeah.
So you get it right away. They have created their a mystique, and they know it, and they're they work with a punch list. You can see it, and that every year they never stop making that place better, which is, you know, pretty cool.
Yeah, absolutely. So they lead you to your cabin?
Yes. They have a young person who's in a you know, something of a golf cart, mm-hmm. And once all of the cars in the party are assembled, mm-hmm. They'll, you know, drive you down the road.
So your host was there at this point?
Yes, yeah, the host had to be there. So he was. So we're all there, and
was it Bill Gates? You don't have to answer.
No.
Okay. All right. Okay.
It wasn't Bill Gates.
Okay. So you get down to the cab. What did you guys do that night?
Well, that is a, you know, the Augusta experience is something. I mean, in the first place, when you're looking, if you know, if you're looking on television at the picture or the image of the clubhouse coming down Magnolia Lane, the cabins are to the left, and they wind. From the left of the clubhouse down the 10th hole. You don't see them when you're going down 10 because of all the trees, but they're not exactly cabins. You know, they call them cabins, but I mean, they're.
Oh, this is where, like, Rory hit?
Yeah.
That
this
one
is
year,
where Rory hit.
Left? Okay.
Yeah.
Got it.
You see some of the cabins, you know, and they're. You know, there were residences that, you know, I believe. I've forgotten a lot of the history I've read about it, but I think that the members would build these themselves, you know, with their own money, and then they'd of course call them the Butler cabin, the Eisenhower cabin, the this cabin and that cabin.
Yeah.
We stayed in what is called the bachelor quarters, which is an upstairs and a downstairs, and let's say that there are 12 apartments in there. And this is where Clifford Roberts, who was one of the founders of the place, he and Bobby Jones built the place back in the 30s, and that's where he lived. And then right next to that is the dining room. So how it goes is we're there, it's about 5 o'clock. Our host, we get our bags settled in our rooms, and then we go to tour the clubhouse. And the tour, you know, starts down on the ground floor, and you've got this, you know, this antebellum house, and all those things were rectangles. They were like three-story simple rectangles that then on the first and second floor had porches surrounding that rectangle. So it looks like an enormous place, but it's not all that big when you walk into the inside. Big enough, but we went up. Our host took us all the way up to the third floor, where we got to see the crow's nest, which is the place where the amateurs, you know, bunk down. And it's got a common area, and then it's got, you know, beds and bunk beds and you know, throughout. And that was cool to see. And then we walked downstairs to the library. And I think when we walked into the library, there were only two other guys in the place and having a cocktail. And so that's where our cocktails were served to us. And it was Dan Marino and Peyton Manning. So that wasn't too bad.
No.
It's kind of hard not to have a friendly chat with.
So there's four. There's you, your host, Dan Marino, and Peyton Manning.
No,
having cocktails.
Me
in
and my host and two other guys in our party, and then Dan and Peyton are there just as wide eyed as we were.
Wow.
You know, just to the idea that here you are, you know, in the clubhouse at Augusta National, and you're about to have some hors d'oeuvres and cocktails with. I'm sure they were just as excited to see us.
What did you say to them?
Hey. Hey, have you played here before?
Yeah.
You know, and
are
you excited to be here? Yeah, they had played there before. But they were excited to be there. There was no doubt about it. Wow. We ran into them the next day when we played and chatted with them at the turn. They were on the back nine while we were on the front, and then we flipped over and sure. and. What they do there at Augusta is they don't have a halfway house, but they have a cart that's like a food mm-hmm. truck,
sure.
and they pull it up there between the ninth green and the tenth and the 18th hole, the 18th green and the 10th tee all come together at the top of the hill there outside the clubhouse, and so. So you cross there and just have kibitz with them, and that was fun. But from the library upstairs, then we went into dinner. Now the dining room is just right next door to it, and some of the rules that you run into at Augusta are interesting, and one of them is the dining room, in the first place. There are no menus.
Okay.
And so you you ask the waiter, what would you like? And the waiter says, whatever you want.
What?
Whatever you want.
Okay. So are you at a table with Peyton and Dan?
No, not at this point. They're in the dining room. But
they're still in the library?
No, we're all there. Everybody's in there, and the reason is that one of the rules of the place is, I think everybody's got to be done with dinner. I don't know whether it's 8 or 9 o'clock,
okay?
Because Clifford Roberts was respectful to the help.
Oh, yeah.
In that regard, he knew they had to get up and come into work the next day, and so we're not going to keep them up all night.
Not even for Peyton Manning.
Nobody, yeah, nobody. No, yeah, no. Sure. If President Eisenhower couldn't do it, I doubt that Peyton Manning and Dan Marino would be able.
Yeah, those guys are. That's probably one of the only places where those guys are nobodies, right?
Well, they're. I think that's right. It's not that people don't enjoy that the guys that run the place don't enjoy seeing them around, but no, there are going to be no special exceptions, I think, made for anybody like that.
Wow.
That's just the way Roberts was, and I think that kind of tough attitude, that he had that. It's just simply carried over. Those guys, when they become president of the club, they appreciate that they're putting on Clifford Roberts' mm-hmm. mantle.
Okay. So what did you order?
Well, I ordered fish.
Fish, okay.
Yeah.
You just said fish? They said you can have anything you want,
well,
and your answer is
yeah.
fish?
No,
or,
I don't,
were you more specific?
I don't remember exactly
okay.
whether I had perch or
okay.
or whatever it was, but I do remember that I was eating fish and they just do a magnificent job of as you might imagine. And then, one of the things we got to do after that was go down to the wine cellar. Now, I never thought anything about it, but we walked down these stairs underneath, to a small space, really, that, I think it had, it was kind of shaped like a donut because there was something, whether it's the fireplace that came all the way down in there and then, went
okay,
all the way up.
Sure.
But they had wine, bottle racks, surrounding this thing, and I remember that I looked up and they had old newspaper on the ceiling, like mm-hmm. Back from the 20s, because this was a house, they had a tree nursery there. That's actually
okay.
what it was, what the property was when Jones and McKenzie started building on it. So the building had been there for a while, and at any rate, I was one of the guys in our party handed me pulled a bottle of wine off of the out from the shelf and handed it to me. He said, "How much do you think that bottle of wine is worth?" I said, "I have no idea." He said, $1,500. He said, so far I calculate that there's $1 million worth of wine just on this wall.
Oh, man.
So that having that experience of the clubhouse was, you know, such a thrill. You could almost have called the trip there. But after dinner, we'd retired early, and like as you might imagine, I mean, it was a very difficult to fall asleep right away because next morning you're going to play Augusta National.
Mm-hmm. So what time did you wake up?
Oh man, I was awake before dawn. It was like 5 a.m. And so I just read and waited for everybody to get up. I was almost afraid to walk around the place, because if you've read any of the history, that there's a strictness about the place that's there's no nonsense.
Yeah, right.
Even if you're a member.
Mm-hmm. Sure. So you got up early, probably went back to the dining room for breakfast.
What would you like for breakfast? Whatever you like, sir.
Wow.
Kidneys and sure, no problem at all. So that was great. And then we got to the tee, and the caddies, in their white jumpsuits, they only carry single bags. They don't double bag at Augusta, so it's not a great gig for caddies, but but my guy was a really good guy. He was from Green Bay, and so his caddy name was Lambo, and he was a terrific caddy. But you're standing there on the first tee at Augusta, as we've talked about in the past, I travel with two sets of clubs, one of them right-handed and the other one left-handed, and so. When I got to the first tee, Lambo was staring at my bag with this terrible look on his face, like it was something he couldn't make sense of. And the problem that he had was the driver that I had in the bag was the left-handed driver, and, and he couldn't figure out what I was going to drive lefty. Yeah, all the rest of the clubs were right-handed. I was determined that I was going to play right-handed.
And was it still like the half set? Odd numbers?
No, that's my set. That's what I play with. So anyway, I had to borrow my host's driver off the first tee. He thought what do you mean? You don't have a driver? You're here to get Augusta National. You don't even have a driver to hit? So as soon as there are no carts there at all, except when Lambo, when we discovered what was wrong and that I had a right-handed driver in my bag in the trunk. The cart appeared right like that, and we flew up the hill, got the driver out of the thing and went back. And I'd scrape my drive down the first hole okay, but I had a long shot into the green, so I had to hit a 3-iron, and I just hit a terrible 3-iron. I just scuffed it and knocked it down the fairway, and so my shot into the green was I had about a 70 yard shot from a damp tight lie, and you have to hit up to the green, and you're hitting up to a plateau, and the pin was cut left, so if you yank it, it'll tug it a little bit, it's in a deep bunker. And I was just nervous as can be, and I could just envision just laying the sod over this thing and hitting it about 8 feet.
Right.
And I hit just a great shot, and then all of a sudden the caddies, some of whom were up by the green, are hooting and hollering, and to have encouraging sounds coming out of caddies' mouths, that early in the round was just great, and I knocked it about 8 feet away. And then I just did a great job, and I rolled the putt over this glass-like surface, and it found the bottom of the cup. And I thought, God almighty, I'm even par at Augusta. I think maybe I ought to just go into the clubhouse now and call it a day. Because it was just a great up and down, and it was really fun. And it I've just played really well. When I'd gone to Augusta, I was really injured. You know, I was playing left-handed because, you know, my right side, the breaks of my golf swing were damaged. The farthest I could hit the ball with a full swing driver was about 212, 215 yards. And so, you know, we're playing a golf course. We're not playing from the tournament tees, which are over 7,000.
Right, there's the member tees there, right?
Yeah. Which is 6,400 mm-hmm. yards thereabouts. And but still, you know, I'm hitting wood everywhere. You know, even to the holes that people normally think of as short holes, 14 and 17.
Well, this is before we get to the back nine, are there any memorable holes or shots from the front nine?
Well, I just played really well across the front nine. Just parring any hole. You know, when I came down two, I hit two is just a gorgeous hole.
This is the par five down the hill.
Par five down the hill. I mean, you really feel when you're on this hole that you're in a cathedral because the pines on either side of the fairway, you know, are just so tall. And it's dark, and you're looking out to the south to these, hills and tree-covered hills off in the distance. I mean, it's just a gorgeous sight. I've got a picture of it. I'll show you after we're done. And that's what I was taking pictures. I always enjoy going to courses like that with my camera and taking pictures of my playing partners and I made a great par at two. And you say, well, it's a par five, you're hitting a wedge to a green. Yeah, but you're hitting a wedge to a green where there are slopes on the green, and where you put that ball and how you putt your ball, I mean, you got to be alert all over the place because those greens are lightning even then. And making even a short putt, is a tense moment. If you're not completely confident in what you're doing. So I made a. You know, I parred one, two, and three. Four, I bogeyed. Five, I bogeyed. And then six, which is the great par three, I hit a seven wood, and I love my seven wood, and I hit this thing right at the flag. I knocked it about 10 feet away, and I made the putt, and then I made a great up and down at seven. I knocked it in the front bunker. That's a little that used to be a short hole, and it was fairly short for us. But the green is so so treacherous. There's a false side over on the left side of it, and they cut the pin right against it. So, you know, the play out of the bunker was so. So demanding, because if you hit the ball too far or you tugged it left even a little bit, it would run to the side and go down. So getting up and down out of that to me was just a great experience. And then I get to nine, and I think, gosh, I'm only one over par. Mm-hmm. And I get to nine, and I hit a good drive, but I didn't hit enough, and I tugged the iron, so I'm down in the bunker to the left of the green. And when you get to those bunkers, I mean, it's like you got to hit it up two stories to hit it out of this.
That's what I've heard about the hills and the elevation change, but it doesn't really come across on TV.
The clubhouse sits on a very big hill, and you know you don't really get it, but when you do see them playing up, you know, from down below on nine, and then you see them, you know, hitting down off a 10 tee, that's the only time you ever really on television, you know, get a really good sense, I think, of those elevations. But they really are significant. And And anyway, on nine, I left the first shot in the bunker, and then I just barely got the next one out onto the fringe, and then I had a very difficult two-putt, and I managed to, I think, end up making a 12-footer for a double bogey. So I shot 39, and wow. I thought, God, that is really good. Yeah. I really did. I played really good golf. It was very cool. And then the
back. Sounds so difficult. Was it? Or you talk about the lightning fast greens, elevation. Were you just like hyper aware or present at? Like,
yes.
What's that like playing at a place like that?
Yeah, I would say that's exactly what it was. I mean, I felt like I was really, you know, tuned into the experience. And you could say, well, was it? How about if you fat the first wedge into the bunker and make a six? Mm. You know, does that change everything? Well, maybe it changes everything. But I felt like I was ready to play. You know, and you meet yourself, you know, when you're on the golf course, and you don't know, you know, before you go out what you're going to find, or you don't know, you know, how it's going to be the whole way around. You know, it could all change at Amen yeah. Corner. How about that? You know, but I was in a heightened sense, I think you could say.
Cool.
Yeah.
So the back nine, hole 10 is the par four down the hill. That dogleg left?
Yeah.
Yeah.
Yeah. That is, I played down the hill. I hit two woods to the front hill, and then I found out what everybody who's played down there knows, and that is, even though it looks really uphill, you're going towards Ray's Creek, and so that ball really runs, and so I chipped it long, and made a bogey on the hole, but then 11. Which is the beginning of Amen mm-hmm. Corner.
Is it downhill?
Well, you hit kind of uphill to down and up to the fairway, and then it goes downhill to the green and Ray's Creek and the pond on the left. Yeah, I managed to hit a pretty good drive in the fairway, but I still had a 7-wood. And of course, you think about bailing out to the right
yeah.
and just chipping on the green. And I had played some tribute golf courses where, you know, they'd had Amen Corner 11, 12, okay. and 13 on it. And down in Texas where my sister lives, and never played 11 well. So now I'm really on 11. I really have a 7-wood to the green, and I just creased this thing. Head straight, knocked it onto the green. I thought, oh my God, I've died and gone to heaven. Just see, all the wow. shots over the years, and to see, where all the those exciting things like yeah. Faldo's great shots when he played there, and then the young Augusta guy whose name evades me right now, who chipped in against the shark in the playoff, mm-hmm. and so many great things have happened there, and just it's just a moment seeing that wood shot zipping through the air, at the green. It's just something I'll never forget. But then I got to the next hole, the 12th hole, and now we've got this little par three, and the pin is back right where it often is on Sunday, and I'm thinking to myself, God, I hope I don't fat this into the water. You can see that I walk around with there's a worry part of me that's always walking around.
Mm-hmm.
But I was taking pictures. I took pictures of all the guys, in my group hitting towards the setting up and then sure. following through. My caddy, grabbed my camera, and he took pictures of me doing the same thing. And I hit this little cut 145 yards, and I'm having to hit a 5-iron, but that's the truth of it. So I hit this little cut 5-iron, and I hit it about a foot from the hole. Oh. It was so I've hit two, you know, unbelievable shots here at Amen Corner, and I'm just you know, I know I've got a trophy that, you know, I'll have for the rest of my life. And then I play 13, and
so
I'm
before you, after 12 though, isn't, don't you like get to a place where like no one else can go? The like walking to 13T, like,
well, the 13th tee, yeah, they don't allow spectators back there. Okay. Yeah, so spectators don't go there. They stay in the bleachers that are behind the 12th tee, and they watch the guys hit from there.
Okay.
So yeah, being back there, yeah, you know, you're in a place that most of the people you know will never never walk back there.
Mm-hmm.
But and it's a great looking shot, you know, to look out at the creek at the corner and the trees, and then you know, then the pine trees through the fairway, I hit my drag to drive left and hit it down by the creek and had to chip out, and then I end up hitting an iron short of the green that rolls back into the creek. So now I actually have to. I said, well, I got to do this, don't I? I mean, yeah. I rolled up, took off my shoes, rolled up my pants, and hit a shot out of the creek. I mean, I felt like I'd been baptized. I mean, you'd say, well, it didn't do anything for your score, but no, it didn't do anything for my score, but it sure did something for me, you know.
Oh, yeah.
And I hit it out of there. I never hit a shot out of water before. And, you know, the ball was kind of half in and, you know, but it came out just like a sand shot. So, so not so bad. So, and then, you know, I think then, playing up, let's say, you know, 14, you don't, you know, think too much of it, 'cause it's not, there's nothing off the tee that you're hitting up a hill and there are trees on either side. And, you know, like I said, I hit the ball as good as I could. I probably hit about 185 yards up the hill. So now I've still got a, you know, 200-yard shot into the green, and I'm hitting 5-wood. And I hit it good, but, you know, I think it trickled over the green or whatever it was. I don't remember exactly, but I bogeyed the hole. And then I came down 15. And 15's that par 5 that you see all the tour players are, you know, hitting 5 irons and 6 irons into the green and stuff like that. Well, you know, even from the member tees, you know, well, what happened was I hit my ball behind those two big trees down the fairway, so I had to punch down under it. Mm-hmm. And you have that wedge lie, the downhill wedge lie, that now you're hitting, and that 15th green just looks like a, looks like you're just hitting to a bowling ball. It really does. I mean, it's just a, it sits there, and it is, it's sloped, and it's shallow, and it's easy to hit your ball into the water in front of the green, but it's also easy to hit your ball in the water over the green if you scull it. And I hit a good shot in there, and I made the putt for birdie.
Wow.
So, then 16 was one of my really favorite, shots, 'cause the pin, and 16 was cut left where Tiger chipped the ball in the hole. So I hit a not a very good shot, and it manages to get kind of over the water, but it comes back, and it's not in the bunker, but it's in the it's on the hill short of the bunker, and now so the ball is literally up around my thighs.
Okay.
I'm standing there, and Lambeau is telling me to just wedge it, you know, over the bunker right at the hole. And I'm thinking, oh, I'm not going to do that. I mean, that's crazy. You know, I'm going to use the slope. You know, so I'm going to play this ball up past the hole and use the backboard and hit it past the hole and let the slope feed it down. And, you know, I'd seen the pros do it, right? Yeah. So I did, you know, I took the bunker out of play. Mm-hmm. I was able to hit a low, you know, kind of running shot. I didn't have to, you know, clip a sand wedge off of a side hill lie, severe side hill lie, and the ball came back to about 3.5 feet, and I knocked it in for a par. I thought, that's got to be one of the great pars I've ever made in my life.
Yeah, no kidding. Wow.
So then 17, I think I bogeyed, and 18, I got to 18, and took pictures of everybody. That's, you know, such an iconic view. And hit my ball up the fairway, and I hit a 5-iron that got onto the green. But when I got up to the green, I saw, you know, I had a putt. And if you remember the picture, the shot, you know, from behind the green, the pin is left front, and my ball is on the upper shelf on the right side of your view if you're looking back down.
So as far away as you can be.
Well, it wasn't all that far because I was only on the beginning of the shelf.
Okay.
So I had a putt that looked like it might break 2 feet. And so I start to line it up, and my caddy goes, "Whoa, wait a minute. no, this putt breaks 20 feet.
Okay.
And you got to hit it over here up onto the fringe and let it feed back." And you've seen that.
Yeah,
you've seen these guys starting to do that. Well, it just, I'm going to tell you, it absolutely doesn't look like that when you look at it. It just looks, it's one of those things about hills.
Mm-hmm.
And a, you know, sloping land that is very difficult to see, and it requires local knowledge and the caddy. So that was cool to hit that putt, you know, to hit something
for
that's
sure.
Not even close to the line that goes, you know, directly to the hole. So that was a great round, and then you know, we had lunch and we got to play the short course.
Wow.
And the short course is just a absolute pleasure. It's so beautiful. You know, it's on the other side of the cabins.
Okay.
And it goes around this pond. I'm not sure if they built that pond as maybe they, you know, I wouldn't be surprised that they built that. It's an enormous pond, but I imagine it retains water and they probably pump water, you know, from it to put on the golf course. I'll have to look that up because it's part of the charm of the place. That par three tournament is just a magnificent family kind of fun experience, and it's, you know, so such a gorgeous green fun thing. It was just great.
Cool. What did you end up shooting on your 18? 76. Wow.
Yeah.
Pretty good. Really good.
Yeah. It was. It was really. It was really good. I mean, it just was. I feel like, you know, it's funny. I feel like, you know, early in my life, golf was a tough love sport. You know, there was a lot of lessons to be learned, but later in my life, I feel like, you know, these golf courses, you know, did very nice things for me. I mean, they left me with wonderful memories, treated me pretty good, and that was, you know, whether I got to play Cyprus one, you know, a couple of times, and the same kind of experience came out of that, and the Augusta experience was a total surprise in so many ways to me, and it really a surprise to play that well, because, you know, I wasn't playing golf right-handed then, you know.
Oh, okay.
I wasn't, you know, I was hurt and you know, and was doing all of my playing left-handed, and so just to be able to, you know, pull your game out and visit it at Augusta and have it work out is like
something else.
Wow. That's pretty good. Mm-hmm. Yeah, it was a wonderful, I want to say, you know, although I'm protecting his name, I have to say that my host, he was just fantastic the way he had us experience the place, and it was really, and I think all those guys that are members there, I mean, they really cherish the opportunity, and there's a reverence you can feel, you know, with them, anybody who's a member there, that they feel, you know, that they have a responsibility to show the place, you know, as well as they can, and they if my host is an example of them, and I think he is, they really do a they take their job very seriously, and they do a terrific job. Wow.
So after the par three course, did you leave?
Yes.
What did it feel like to leave?
Well, you know, I mean, I was energized by the whole experience. It wasn't, I felt it, you know, somehow I felt kind of initiated. You know, I mean, when I waved goodbye to the gate guard, you know, it was like, it was certainly different from being a guest walking in. You know, I felt like, you know, he looked at me and he knew, you know, because he'd seen other guys like me with that same smile on their face, you know, come out. And, it's definitely something, it kind of reminded me of when my daughter was born, because prior to my daughter being born, I really hadn't really thought that much about being a parent. And I really didn't think, you know, that I would miss much in life if I didn't experience parenthood. And then I realized once she was born how wrong that whole line of thinking was. But, and I felt the same, somewhat similar about Augusta. You know, I'd said to myself, well, it's okay if I don't get to play here. You know, there are other great experiences in life, and there are. Mm-hmm. But I have to say, getting a chance to be there and to walk around and to, you know, appreciate what they've done. You know, the fact that Jones and McKenzie built that golf course, that Trent Jones came in and redid, you know, some of the holes, like 16 and 10, I think. And what they do there, it's a living work of art. And, I mean, the art is you know, not just in the design. It's in how they function. Mm-hmm. You know, that they're always looking to improve things, and I just you know, that's an inspiring thing to be around.
Yeah, I wonder if part of what made the experience so amazing was that you actually, like, were at a place where you would have been okay if you hadn't have gone to it. Like, do you think if you had lived your whole life just like dying to play Augusta and just disappointed year after year after year that you'd never played, that like you almost would have built it up into something that you wouldn't have been able to experience in the same way?
Yeah. Yeah. I think there's no doubt, you know, that I'm not sure exactly what the, you know, the combination was, but, there was definitely, I definitely benefited, you know, from the stage of life that I was, you know, in. That I went to the golf course with a more of a sense of appreciation, you know, for the experience. And I've faced the question, you know, enough times in my life, like, well, what would it mean, you know, if you didn't play well? You know, and to have kind of gone through that lesson, you know, with myself enough times that I now can actually kind of coach myself, you know, through that performance anxiety or that, you know, that desperate desire for the score, that I can stand up to that in a better way than I could when I was younger and get more out of myself, you know, because we all want to stand in the moment and give it our best, right? Yeah. We don't want to sabotage ourselves, but, you know, that's one of the great things about golf, I think, is that it gives you a chance over and over again if you are someone who sabotages themselves or halves on some occasions, you reach your choke point. Like Johnny Miller, you know, had always maintained that he thought overcoming chokes was the highest level of achievement in the game, that it was really an elegant part of the game where you're really dealing with yourself on a, you know, at a very core level,
yeah,
and
sure.
you're able to improve.
Mm-hmm.
You know, I think that that's, I look at, you know, that experience at Augusta and say, yeah, I mean, I was better than I had ever yeah. been, you know, in my life at being able to, you know, not, I wouldn't say, oh, no, I would call it a kind of a tournament excitement. You know, you can say, well, it's just a casual round of golf. I mean, that's not the same as a tournament. And I would say, yes, that's true. As Bob Jones said, there's golf and then there's tournament golf.
Mm-hmm.
But there's it just means that there's a level of excitement,
yeah.
you know, that that I don't think you necessarily have to be in a tournament to get it. You know, when you're as long as you want something and it means something to you, you know, there's a competitive level of excitement there.
Mm-hmm. Yeah, I think it's interesting that what you would almost call that level of excitement. A tournament excitement, if you had played bad, it would be deemed a failure. And I feel like, you know, we don't know what would have happened if you had played bad that day. But I would imagine you wouldn't be saying it was a failure. You would be able to come here and talk about it and tell great stories just the same, which is part of what makes it such a great, you know, a great experience.
Yes, I agree. I agree with that. And I think that is what opens the door for you. Because, you know, I had this feeling. I knew, you know, that there were certain shots and certain moments that, you know, you can feel inside of you that you're, like I said, when I got onto the 12th and thinking, you know, I'd seen Spieth,
yeah.
I'd seen many players, you know, plunk the ball into Ray's Creek in the front of that green, and had done it myself on the tribute course, you know? And so, you know, when you know, I think, you know, being brave is, you know, overcoming fear. I think if you don't feel fear,
mm-hmm.
if you don't acknowledge it, I mean, even that young man, you know, that they made the Free Solo, the movie about the young man that climbs without ropes. Now, you can say, well, that kid, you know, doesn't have fear. No, he does have fear. He does, and he experiences less than you or I might,
yeah.
you know, but he experiences it. And
sure.
Now, if he didn't, then, you know, you would say, well, he must be just
a crazy person.
Crazy person, yeah.
Mm-hmm.
So.
Cool.
Yeah.
Well, Pete, this was a real pleasure. Thanks a lot for
yes.
joining us.
Thanks for giving me a chance to relive it.
Absolutely.
It's always fun.
We'll talk to you next time.
All righty.
Clean contact.
I'd hit it again because that shot was a defining moment. And when a defining moment comes along, you define the moment, or the moment defines you.